I think three things for this evening. Number one, to just kind of recap where we were at our kickoff meeting. Number two, I'd like to, what I've done, as we've listened to both staff, had the tours, listened to the public, what I have proposed that we would start discussing tonight is kind of a high-level model for CIP planning and governance. So I want to go over that. And then thirdly, I guess we decide where we go forward. So without that, without any further comments, just a review of meeting number one and discussion points.
Yeah, we had also put in here just like a review of the charge. This is something mm-hmm. that we're going to be including in all the subcommittee meetings as well as the broader joint task force. And just for this one, I mean, the first bullet obviously applying to the greater task force. So guidance in terms of recommending and framing the CIP for 19 through 28. And then below is how the subcommittees were formed. And so I highlighted in red more of what applies here in this setting. So reviewing and recommending municipal facility planning and civic engagement principles, standards, and practices. And then reviewing and recommending governance of capital planning and project delivery. So just so we
refresh,
revisit what we're here for. There are no community comments, I'm guessing?
No community comments.
No community. So what we did last time.
Yeah, so just in terms of meeting number one, I know part of how you started that meeting was defining a vision for success. And so we had put some of the high bullet points in here. Obviously, the meeting minutes are captured online if anyone wants the full version. But thinking in terms of consistency and coherence in the capital planning process, long-term thinking was mentioned beyond the 3 to 5 year idea, looking much longer term. A process that's traceable from planning through design and into execution, and then at all stages in between. The desire to see projects delivered on schedule within budget and scope, but also providing the proper level of benefits to the citizen or residents of Alexandria. And then another thing we heard was more discipline in determining how projects get into the CIP. And then other discussion points that came out. Also looking in terms of the analysis of project operations, considered as a part of the subcommittee and CIP process. We heard a presentation or discussion, if you will, from the city as well as ACPS on their respective processes. And I know there was some action items that came out of that the city and schools have been compiling. And then it was mentioned in terms of how a project model was defined was from identification of a need through the fielding of a capability. So thinking from that perspective of a model, and then other issues for considerations during the subcommittee meetings. We didn't list all of those out, but they are in the fuller meeting notes.
Pretty complete summary.
Okay. But if I could add something now, as we've been thinking about some of the other things, another element of a vision for success, it seems, what gets approved gets built.
Yes.
What I mean by that, if we're going to go through a big process and we're going to have all these projects and we're going to rank them, there seems to me that there's a disconnect if we then just send money over to a different body and they can build what they want with that money. I don't mean that to kick on the school. Been part of the process to date, but it seems to me if we're going to have a more integrated capital planning process for the whole city and we're going to do projects and we're going to consider how to do joint projects and things like that, it would seem totally counterproductive if the council were to appropriate money and the school board would go and do something else. If we're going to do it jointly, we should do it jointly. Now, I don't know how much of a problem that is today. I don't know how frequently that happens. But can you imagine if we decided we're going to do a joint project and we go through all the planning and the council appropriates the money and then the next thing that happens is the school board says, oh, we're actually not going to do that on the timetable that you all agreed to. We're going to do this other thing. stick. There just has to be discipline around how we do it. Not that there can't be changes, because there are sure changes on both sides. In fact, Elliot, you had asked for the capital improvement program to be forwarded to us today, and it was very instructive. You kind of knew that this was the case, but a huge leap from 1 year to the next. I understand that there's going to be those changes, but we should subject the changes to a, probably a higher level of discipline.
So I think it's a fair comment.
When you say from 1 year to the next, do you mean from the previous CIP to the next one that was developed, or you mean from?
Sure, there's a level of consistency mm-hmm. there, but I think the what I'm really talking about is in the upcoming fiscal year, year one of the CIP, if you will. Because year one is actually, we're going to build these things, or we're going to start, we're going to commit these dollars, actually, in the upcoming fiscal year. And it seems to me that there should be enough discipline on both sides of that decision making that says if that project is there as a year one project, that's where the money has to get spent. It can't get spent on something else without coming back without coming back through a process.
Right.
That's really what I'm suggesting. I don't know how we accomplish that, you know, given the autonomy of the school board versus the council, but it's one pot of money. I was actually intrigued when we learned, I assume we all learned at the same time, that we don't actually just write a check to the school for capital projects. The city spends the money on an account mm-hmm. that is a designated school board account. I mean, in essence, it is actually a city project until it gets completed and it gets turned over. So unlike the operating budget, where it's those dollars literally get passed over and they're in school board accounts and the school board spends the operating budget as it wishes.
Yeah, I guess I would characterize it a little differently. Like the city holds those dollars in custody for the school board, I think is a more accurate description. So if the school board chooses to reprioritize that within the categories specified in state law, it's a ministerial act on the part of the city to make. And I think you're talking about something more substantive.
I am. And I don't know how to accomplish it, but to me that would be success, that we don't end up in places. Because it seems to me one of the reasons we're here is there is a level of frustration amongst our elected officials. The things they thought they were approving,
right,
the school board simply changed its mind without coming back through a different process. It's one bucket of tax money. And under state law and under our charter, it is the city council that taxes us as citizens and spends the money. And I think it's fair, full disclosure, if that changes, it should come back through a process.
So I think the process has been, as you've said, to move money between projects, but in terms of the larger capacity projects, we've stayed consistent with those. We're talking about as projects have changed over time, moving money from our non-capacity sections. It's fully within the school board's authority, and really that's what has been moved in the past. We also think that because we are getting a one-year appropriation, and then the following year we're getting another appropriation, and we don't know exactly what it'll be, it's difficult to plan some of these projects long-term. There has been a need to change direction. And really take some of the smaller projects to look at other areas.
Yeah, I'm sure that's true, and I'm sure it's true on the other side of the house as well. All I'm saying is it's a member of the public, and my perception as to why we're here is there's some level of frustration. I'll call it truth in advertising, is perhaps too strong a word, that, you know, something gets approved, there's premises behind it, and then that's not what actually happens. So however we can take that uncertainty out, that to me is success.
I think that's fair. And I'll just kind of use an analogy. If you've ever worked in a job shop of any kind, right, whether it's an auto shop or a small manufacturing shop, the worst thing you can have is the craftsman chasing the work. And I think there's a perception that if you kind of consider the capital budget as a portfolio, as a a body of work to be done over time. There is some concern about the dollars chasing that work. And when the dollars chase that work, there is not necessarily coherent execution on that work, is what I hear you saying. So I think, just to add to what looks like success, understanding that the school board is both an elected body, while the city exercises the power to tax, that there needs to be some transparency so the citizenry can understand how well those capital needs are being executed on behalf of citizens today in the future, because it's our job as citizens to hold both bodies accountable.
I think that's right. I mean, you could come up with a scenario under which we go through this effort, which was mutually agreed to by the school board and by the city council, and we prioritize, as I understand it, our mission is to prioritize all the projects, right? And it's not an artificial, even though we've got the goal of S&C, we're going to look at all the projects and we're going to say,
single pot.
We're going to recommend up until here's the cutoff, right? It would be rather strange if, after going through all of that effort, the school board could simply just say, actually, we're going to do different things than what came out of that process.
Including the ones that we rank below the line.
Correct. That's correct.
But, you know, one context is planning is a living process.
Yes.
And a lot of these projects, it's based on what your crystal ball of what you know today.
Mm-hmm.
And so maybe we can frame this discussion as we go through the next slides about kind of the pre-planning activities and what maybe recommendations or considerations we can make to help that initial first number, and whether there's processes or resources that could help inform that, as well as then how to frame that in a transparent way, about having maybe it's consistent planning language or different templates or whatever it may
right.
be as we get through this, so that way it is clear of how some
sure.
of those assumptions and concepts first came to be.
And believe me, I understand that, you know, that nobody's crystal ball is perfect.
Yes.
And it is going to change. I think that my expectation as a citizen, and then bringing my private sector experience into play, we shouldn't see a ton of changes in the first 2 years of a capital
mm-hmm.
improvement plan. I expect we're going to see a ton of changes as we get out past year five.
Yes, absolutely.
But with respect to the first couple of years, no, we should know what we're going to be doing in those first couple of
yeah.
years. That's really my
No, point. I agree. So I think that's probably a good segue into the slides I have prepared for us tonight. So what I did is I sat down and I tried to synthesize the discussion around the table. The information we gathered from both schools and from the city, listening to the public comments that we had. And what I want to do tonight is start a discussion about a model, because, you know, frankly, it is the last week of September, and at some point we're going to have to start writing. We're going to need a deliverable. So I thought this was as good a time as any to start that discussion. So if we could have the next slide.
Do you want to take this, or want me to just?
I'll do it. I'm happy to do it. Okay. So what I wanted to do today is kind of throw out a notional capability delivery model. And I go back to some of the things that I have said in earlier plenary sessions. We should not get too focused on projects. This is about delivering capability or delivering a capability that allows both the city and schools to deliver capability to taxpayers. So that may well be a level of abstraction, and I understand that, but if you don't continue to go back to that concept, you can build a project for a project's sake. And I don't think anybody thinks that's fiscally responsible, nor does it serve the citizen. So I want to talk about a proposed capability delivery model. I also want to talk about proposed constraints and necessary conditions. And what I mean by that is models are nice, okay? They're rarely complete, they're rarely perfect, they work in a real world, and we have some real world constraints and necessary conditions. One is a budget calendar, right? So whatever we do needs to be synchronized with the budget calendar. Two is the way the Virginia Code allocates authority between the city and schools. So to your point, Eric, the schools have a right under the code to spend money as they see fit, as long as that money is spent in certain categories. I guess the level of granularity that the city council can go to is clearly defined in the code. There are 7 categories. You can't go below that. After that, schools has complete autonomy in their spending. So I want to frame this discussion in terms of those things we know are constraints and necessary conditions. The other thing that I'd like to do this evening is I would like to start us on these discussion questions. So in that light, what I have done is I have put those discussion questions at the beginning of this presentation, and you will see them again at the end. So I want you thinking about these questions as I step through this model. So the first is the model relevant and appropriate? Is this a good way to think about how we ought to do capital planning and governance in the city of Alexandria? And if not, what would we do to modify it? So it is appropriate. The second question is, so what questions should be answered and what information should be available before each stage of the model is considered complete? I look at this as a set of exit criteria. You know, before you commit to a course of action, there are certain things you should either know or know you don't know. And you should decide how you're going to allocate that risk. Are you going to avoid it? Are you going to mitigate it? Are you going to transfer it? Or are you going to accept it? Third, and this goes, you know, to I think, you know, the discussion of governance, who really should be empowered to proceed at each stage. Once we have that information and we're thinking about whether a project is viable to go forward or not, and we're thinking about whether it continues to develop or so that it delivers the benefits or not, who is the decision maker then? And then to your point, the fourth question that we should be thinking about is how we control the funds flow to ensure that citizens get value for dollars. So as I walk through this model, I'd like you to be thinking about that, and we'll come back to these questions, and my goal this evening is to have a dialogue on these questions, at least to start.
Now, if I
sure.
could just ask that we put on the parking lot.
Oh, absolutely.
But when you talked about constraints and the school board's authority versus the council's authority, one of the pieces that I think it would be helpful to gain a better understanding is it possible to have an intergovernmental entity memorandum of understanding that in essence would say, notwithstanding state law, the school board and the city council have agreed that the capital planning process will work in this way.
I think that's a lawyer question.
Why I'm putting it on
absolutely.
The party,
so
I just
but that's a fair question.
Catherine, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems more like it's an item that, like, our joint planning efforts or anything that goes for city council support and school board adoption, and that's how they kind of receive it and agree that they're going to promote the recommendations of the task force.
Right. Okay. So what I've advanced for your consideration is what I call a capability development and delivery framework, and it's got 5 stages. So the first stage is capability need validation, and I'll step through these in detail. The second one is demand management. The third is project strategy. The fourth is project planning, and the fifth is project execution. So what do we mean by this? So let's start with capability need validation. This is the stage in which we answer the question, in order to sustain general government and deliver citizen services, what capabilities must I have? So the easiest and most concrete one is probably fire protection, right? You know, we have a map of the city, we know where people are, we know what the land uses are, we know what risks are, So we ought to be able to model that and say, what capability to fight a fire do I need in a particular area of the city? And this should answer that question. So, you know, if we have a great deal, for example, and we don't, of open space, I'm thinking Winkler, right? You could look at that in the abstract and say, you know, I'm not going to really worry about firefighting at Winkler. You know, the risk is very low. Now, you're not going to say that because of where Winkler is, and there's quite a bit of density there, but I just throw that out as an example. You know, so in this stage, departments, under the guidance of council, ought to be going through and saying, hey, what is my role in delivering services? And what capabilities do I need to deliver services? Another one might be the Department of Revenue and its information system. So you ask yourself what kind of experience you want to have for the citizenry, what kind of safeguards you want to have to essentially collect and administer the revenue process, and that kind of drives IT design. So this is a stage where you say, hey, do I need a capability? And what capability that is to deliver citizen service. The next phase is what I call demand management. And that really answers the question, how do I define and express the material solution that will provide a capability? So I have a capability need, and there are a number of ways that I could fill that capability need. And one of my favorites, as I think about it, is parking meters, right? So before, all of us were carrying around change, you know, for parking meters, right? Many of us are now carrying around these things, you know, with the Pango app on them, and we just pull up, you know, within proximity. We look at the kiosk, and if we have change, or we have bills, or we have credit cards, we go to the kiosk. We get a little slip. Okay? Some of us simply pull out our phones, and for a fee, we're allowed to park in that particular place. And I don't know what magic of technology keeps them from ticketing my car, but I know it always works for me. Well, we've decided, okay, we need a capability to essentially maintain, and with some good order and discipline, the use of parking space in the city, which is why we set rates in addition to revenue use, right? They drive business. I want people in and out of parking spaces at a certain rate. And instead of saying, hey, I need to have a parking meter, okay, which is a project, we say, no, I need a capability, okay, to collect revenue and govern the use of parking spaces. So demand management ties to that capability need, which ties to a general government function or part of the strategic plan. And what it really says is, so what possible material solutions could I use to provide that particular capability? Now, this answer is usually the result of a feasibility study. In my business, we call that an analysis of alternatives, where we sit down and we look at an entire set of alternatives against a set of criteria, and we score them, and we say, hey, we believe this is the best criteria. And I would argue, in a city government, this is where stakeholder engagement begins. And I think about this in terms of swing space, right? So we're, you know, in order to do schools, are going to need 15 to 20 years worth of swing space. Well, we had better be talking to the community about where that swing space goes, because most of the folks that are going to use that over the next 15 to 20 years aren't walking there, they're riding buses there. Well, anybody who's tried to get the 395 or 495 down Route 1 in the morning knows that if you're going to use swing space at Lee Center, you better be engaging with that community, because it's going to very much change that traffic pattern. So generally, when we start to talk about demand management, we start to look at our alternatives. This is where we start to do the community, the stakeholder engagement piece. I would suggest to you lastly that at this stage, we should not be programming significant capital investment, because we don't know what the alternative is going to be. It's going to be the result of stakeholder engagement and a whole other set of constraints and necessary conditions. But this is where we should be budgeting seed money for further project definition.
Can I ask two questions?
Oh, absolutely.
Two questions.
If anybody's got questions, just...
So when we talk about the analysis of alternatives, which we've done in other contexts...
Right.
So one of the things we said was, could we joint venture something
exactly
with Fairfax County?
it would come out in this, in that.
Right, you would start to explore, well, actually, you would start to explore that in the next phase of this model. So let me go ahead.
The second question is on the seed money piece, which
right.
I think makes a lot of sense. Can we ask what the city does today with respect to some of these major projects and the concept of seed money? Because I would imagine it goes beyond internal staff capabilities in many instances to say, okay, here's what this project looks like. Do you appropriate that as operating dollars so that you can do that that analysis? How do you do that?
It's typically capital. In our typical sequence, we have an idea that there's an issue to be resolved mm-hmm. in the continuum of CIP. So you would see, for instance, going back to Charles Houston, early programming, even Patrick Henry Recreation Center, we had early feasibilities, I want to say 2000, maybe 5 years ago, until it could be fit into the mm-hmm. capital window appropriately, and then it got aligned with the school when that synergy happened. Originally, Patrick Henry was going to be a standalone, and then it was clearly
right.
identified that schools had a need, so we stalled that one to line up the projects together. So it is typically capital funded, which in this context would mean that you have something in line item in the capital budget.
Right.
And I think it goes to probably one of the earlier comments of expectations versus where we're going. You know,
yeah.
This is sort of the convergence of what's the right path at the
right
time.
Right. No, absolutely.
Because I like what you're saying on this one, Elliot, is actually that's a piece of how we do it.
Sure.
Which is we, rather than saying, okay, we've got to set aside 25% in the capital
right.
budget, we actually don't know how much we're going
right.
to have to ultimately set aside. So we say, okay, here's $500,000. Now you need to scope that. You need to do
it, exactly. Because you might get to the end of this phase and say, you know, that project's not worth
right.
doing. It's just not worth doing. I'm not going to get enough benefit out of it. Were there higher priorities? So I'm glad I spent $150,000 doing a feasibility study to figure that out before I went and committed significantly.
And that's,
yeah, go ahead.
I'm sorry. That's something that you all could consider when you come back to the larger task force
right.
and you're asked to program $539 million over 10 to 15 years, then you could say, and one of your recommendations is we should carve a piece of that out for project development.
Right.
If I can say for the school side, so I know we do a couple different things. So we have a system-wide planning account, basically, that we use as needed for things like long-range facilities plan and then any other kind of if we have an emergency and we need to design it, we'll use it for that or any other kind of planning like that. And then we, the school board knew that the feasibility of the high school would need to be looked at. So in FY 2018, they allocated $100,000 to begin looking. And then for all of our major capital projects, I'm sure you saw, we put our design money, basically to get the architect on board and
right.
whoever else we need to
right.
start procuring the project the year in advance of the actual
right.
construction project.
Right now, that's, I just want to make sure, where's my cheat sheet? MacArthur's the next one. Is there, for any of those upcoming elementaries, are there?
So all of them are a two-year process.
Two
so
plates.
Like we have, a lot of it was deferred too, so it's not as much upfront planning as we
mm-hmm.
would like, but so Swing Space, the full budget is proposed in FY 2019. And then we have the design funds for Douglas MacArthur in 2020 and the construction
gotcha.
In 2021. And then all the elementary go out like that.
That's the design. Do you have any plans for feasibility studies for those?
So, no. So it was
okay.
all, it's just it's
all
basically
together.
20% of the total construction,
okay.
estimated construction cost for feasibility design, bringing on project management, stuff like that.
Okay. So to your earlier question, right, is this where you start looking at partnering? And it's really project strategy. So this starts to define the who, what, when, where, and how, right? So who's going to do this project, right? Is it schools? You know, is it the city? You know, what exactly are we talking about? You know, at a fairly high level, when? So we start to talk about the timing. We start to talk about site, and the how gets to kind of that partnership. So this is where you would start looking at private-public venture. This is where you would start looking at dual-use facilities. This is where you start to get really into the progressive elaboration of what that project starts to look at like. So heavy stakeholder engagement. You know, now I really ought to have stakeholders involved because I'm starting to say, you know, I'm going to redevelop a landmark in the West End, and I'm taking part of that by eminent domain, and this is what it's going to look like. So heavy stakeholder involvement here. This is the time where you start to look at private-public partnership as well. And this should be probably the first tranche of significant CIP funding, because you really are now starting to put the outlines around the project. But the strategy part, I think, is absolutely a critical step. This is where, if you will, I believe, the political leadership in the community is starting to write that first contract with the citizens. Like, this is no kidding going to happen. And this is what it's going to start to look like, and this is when it's going to arrive, and these are the benefits it's going to provide. Oh, and by the way, this is what it's going to cost. And you know, I think importantly, this is how we're going to finance it, because, you know, I spent a fair amount of time on DFAC, and we would have this discussion in the CIP section of the report, and it was a philosophical one, right? So conservatively, you could finance some of this, a fair amount of this, with cash capital. Okay, but by doing so, you put that burden on current taxpayers. And there was always a discussion as to what the right balance between cash capital was and debt financing, because we are a city that has almost a phobia about debt. But I think the important philosophical aspect of using debt is it drives the people who are going to benefit from the project, which is a long duration, to pay its cost, right? Because, you know, we build it, we service it with debt, we pay, you know, interest, and we pay principal, and that means taxpayers who live here 10 years from now, who are going to reap the benefits of what we decided to build, will share the burden of doing that. So this is where you really start to say, okay, what are my sources? How am I going to allocate that across cash capital and CIP? Do I want to engage in a private-public partnership, which has its own, you know, very, very specific, you know, risks, you know, and rewards, as we can see from toll roads? And this is where we should see probably the first real significant tranche of CIP funding.
So to that point, yeah. Could I just ask clarification,
yeah, absolutely,
in terms of how the city, I think I know the answer, but I want to make sure. The CIP is kind of a cash budget, is that right? I mean, so if a project on the CIP is expected to take 3 years, then you're going to show 3 years of expenditures in the CIP.
No, because we need to appropriate the full funding
for the project,
right, for in order to engage in the purchasing. So we would put, like, for instance, Potomac,
right,
Yard, we appropriated $270 million in 1 year. We
haven't started construction. And that would all be in the initiation year?
Right. But we do also, we track the, that's correct. We also ask for the cash flows separately.
Right.
So we could, you know, we could look at that separately.
But on the CIP, you're actually,
right,
showing it in,
right,
the year of initiation,
right, yeah,
the year of commitment, I,
right,
suppose.
But
that's,
it,
correct.
But I think we need to remember that there's a subtlety here, right? So I could go, I would argue, to this gate, right? And I could say, you know, this project won't provide the benefits, or it's not feasible at this point. So I would argue you could, and consistent with practice, you could appropriate the money that allows you to get to that. That when you drop that large appropriation in the CIP, what you're really doing is you're saying this project's a go. So there's no need to do it back here before you decide, you know, that this is something that's sufficiently well defined, has plenty of stakeholder involvement, and I know how I'm going to do it from a strategic point. You can drop enough money in there to get to that point, and then you can decide this project's a go, and council could appropriate that money at that point, say.
And does the city,
yeah,
get its bond financing at the time of the project initiation?
So that is, without getting too far into the weeds, that is where we have more flexibility, where we could appropriate full funding in year one, but then knowing that we're not going to spend all of it in year one, we could just size our issuance to cover the portion that we expect to spend for that year, and then, you know, the future debt issuances in our model accordingly. And we also have a process of allocating funds after they've been appropriated. So once you get your initial appropriation, you still have to come back for an allocation request so we can fully appropriate a project, but then allocate different pieces.
Yeah, Jeremy, I think you had something to add.
Just one point in this timing and sequence, which is always at risk, is once you go through the feasibility stage and you've got a fairly robust set of analysis that's performed, the actual lag in timing becomes pretty important to the actual final scope of what's going to be built. And so just as we're wording recommendations, I would certainly put in that caveat, because when you reopen a project, say you go through the stage gate and you do feasibility and it's got all the merits and credits and it moves forward to the next stage and actually has a budget year, and that budget year becomes year five. Well, in the intervening 5 years, you know, scope, project, staff, I mean, the whole context, a new council, other leadership occurs. So there's always that risk and caveat of,
and there's always
that struggle of seeing, and we've had, I think everyone has examples of that, of, you know, we start with a concept, we build it out, we get in the budget, and then 3 years down the road, it's something completely different than...
It's the nature of capital and government.
Yeah.
That's why I have a three submarine class. You're absolutely smart. We only built three. Project planning, so this is really an integration of the outputs from the project strategy stage, right? So we are now getting them to a level of granularity where we are out of the conceptual stage. We probably have bid documents. We're probably drafting RFPs. We're doing that kind of work to bring somebody on to really go do this. So increased definition, both, you know, scope, cost, and schedule, and project planning typically ends with a contract. we're bringing on somebody to build whatever the project goes.
And so to put it in the context of the city's approach, you couldn't really enter this unless you've got an approved CIP project.
Right. Yeah, you got to have what we would call full funding policy, right? It's got to be, at that point, it's got to be fully funded.
Versus project strategy.
Right.
Could have been using seed money to get through it.
Exactly. That's
because it's also important to note that, you know, even if it's a multi-year project,
right,
once you commit, you commit. You sort of, even though it might take you 3 years to spend the dollars, just out appropriating 1 year
and
after
outlays,
the next is you know, once you start it, you're committed to it.
And then the last stage, right, project execution, where the work is monitored and controlled, and collateral work is done to deploy capability. And what I mean by collateral work is, so we bring on a capital project, and there is probably, you know, some hit to the operating budget to do that. So you are not going to, and I'll pick on schools, right? You're not going to build a second high school that's going to have a heavy technology base without then budgeting for the IT infrastructure to go inside that school. And that's not necessarily going to be part of the construction project. That may be another line in the property plant equipment or furniture and fixtures line item in the budget, but you're going to do that, right? You are going to start to retrain people, you know, your teaching workforce to be able to exploit that technology. You're going to start to hire IT resource people. So there's a set of collateral work that has to be done that does not necessarily affect the project budget, but must be done in parallel with that project being executed to fully deploy the capability. So this is just kind of a very generalized model, and I would argue that each one of these could present some opportunities to do some governance work, which is why I've put it up here. Some things, I think
this is, go ahead. In terms of that last point, the collateral work, when we had a little bit of a conversation about this at the plenary session.
Right.
Is, I think we probably need to articulate somewhere in here, and it probably is in this project strategy piece,
mm-hmm.
what collateral work, what operating budget impacts are going to result from this.
No, absolutely. That, and I think, and this is something we've been talking around, but I don't know that we've ever addressed head on, but I, at that point, when you're talking project strategy, I want to see life cycle costs. Because I know in my business, the rule of thumb is 30% of the cost is acquisition cost, 70% of it's operation and sustainment cost. So you want to make sure that the commitment you're making by putting that building up is one you're willing to follow through in the operating budget as well.
So, because I've had that come up in different planning exercises, and that request to look at life cycle cost. So kind of backing up to see what level of concept has been defined at this point to try to model, I guess maybe it's to what degree are you looking for at this stage? Because I mean, there's the extreme, the energy modeling you would have once a project's actually designed and you're going through maybe your LEED certification and you actually have engineers who have real design to react to. Then in this phase where we only have seed money to get through, how are we trying to model that?
I'll give you my opinion.
Okay.
Okay. And I think it's that stage where you identify what the cost drivers are going to be, right? And once you identify the cost drivers, then you start to use whatever available models are. So I'll pick a really obvious example.
Mm-hmm.
So if I'm going to recapitalize the Dash fleet or the school bus fleet, right? The cost driver is pretty clear. It's petroleum, oil, and lubricants, probably in people. So, I can start to sit down and get some notion, when I look at a set of mm-hmm. alternatives, right, as to what rolling stock I'm going to buy, what the life cycle cost is going to be, simply because I know what the chief cost drivers are. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't suggest that you need to get down to, the granular level of, I've now got this HVAC system, and it's got this kind of throw weight on it, and we're going to do some mm-hmm. extreme energy modeling. But if you are, talking about the firing range, for example, then one of the drivers there may be environmental abatement cost on an ongoing basis, right, because you want to take the lead out of the facility, you want to make sure it's safe for people to use, to use and to operate. So you would be looking for the larger cost drivers, and you would be looking to model those so you had some idea mm-hmm. of what the life cycle cost would be. I mean, that's kind of my view, because you could spend a lot of time going through a lot of elaborate models, and you could spend all your seed money modeling things, and you could lose the opportunity to build a project. And it's analysis by paralysis, or mm-hmm. paralysis by analysis.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you how we do it at our place. Everything has a P&L, regardless of what kind of capital project it is. There is associated with the project a P&L,
right.
And it's multi-year. And at least in our instance, you're layering in your operating costs, and if you have to hire more IT people to support it, or more, if you're building another school, that's another principal, that's a set of fixed costs associated with it. But it also has the depreciation, it has the interest carry associated with it. So, that puts a level of discipline on people who say, yeah, I'd like a new building. Well, but can you support that
exactly.
from a revenue perspective? Now, I understand it's going to be different here. But I think the point is similar, and it's not, as you say, it's not down at that super granular level,
yeah.
but it is at least at the point that says, if you were doing funded depreciation to pay for those things, this is your P&L.
Right. Now, I think a really good point. So the carrying cost,
mm-hmm.
As well. So project, execution, this is where, you monitor and control things. This is where the collateral work is done to deploy the capability, not necessarily in the capital budget. So that's an important thing to be thinking about. So I just want to observe here, I mean, this could be an arduous process, But I would argue that not all capital projects start at the same place. So they don't all start at capability needs validation. And you know, I'm just kind of thinking out loud here, so no pride of authorship, but I would argue that projects really fall into three groups, right? So it's life extension of existing assets. Think about it. The roof on City Hall, the HVAC system. Now, I might get some efficiency out of that, energy efficiency, because that's a technology upgrade, but I'm not seeking that. Really, what I'm seeking to do is to keep, you know, visitors and staff dry and comfortable. So I'm going to extend the life of this building by simply replacing that particular set of assets. You wouldn't start that at capability needs validation. We already kind of know that, right? You'd probably start somewhere halfway through project strategy, because there's some things in project strategy you wouldn't think about. You're not going to name the HVAC unit, you know, after a corporate donor, so let's not worry about private-public venture. But you may have some stakeholder issues to deal with. You've got employees to deal with, you've got union work rules to deal with, you've got the inconvenience to the populace coming into City Hall to do services to deal with, so you might have to move. You're going to think about things. So life extension of existing assets, probably not going to start at capabilities need verification, probably going to start somewhere in the middle of the project strategy stroke.
I ask a question.
Sure.
There, with like your example, the roof replacement, that is, it's in kind. It isn't the difference between the modernization. Say you were going to put a green, you know, a white roof or green roof on here, and it's not one already. So you're kind of upgrading it.
Well, a couple of things. So you might look at that, and it might drive you kind of iteratively through the model. So you might, in doing your market research about roof replacement, say, hey, you know, there's a business case here from an energy perspective and from a strategic plan perspective to drive that into the second category, which may drive you back to do a little more due diligence.
Okay.
You know, so this model is not entirely linear either.
Yep.
I mean, that's just important to remember. You know, again, I go back to this. You know, most models aren't complete, nor are they perfect. What they help you understand is the issues involved in the process.
Okay.
The second tranche is, go ahead.
And to that point, that they're not linear, maybe we could actually change the graphic that shows these feedback loops.
Right. No, that's good.
So the casual.
We've been playing with, I think we've, because that wasn't the graphic I sent in. So we can probably put it in one of those nice little circles or something.
Yeah, we're trying to make it easier to see.
No, it's all good. So modernization of existing assets. Here is where I want to add additional service capability. So I'm going to take, and this is a horrible example, but I'll use it anyway. I'm gonna look at George Mason, and I'm gonna look at the electrical plant in that basement. That was clearly a modernization. Okay, it may have looked like an in-kind replacement, but you can look at the switchboards in that basement and tell that, hey, we added significant capability, probably to handle the IT plan. You know, so we provided additional service capability in that facility when we went through and did that. And again, that's probably not going to start, necessarily in the same place. It may start in capability needs validation. Okay, but it may well skip demand management because it's an in-kind, you know, type of system. So I may go back, and we may make the case, and I'll pick another example, wireless in this building for citizen use. We may say, hey, we need to be able to deliver that because everybody is connected to their devices. Well, we're probably not going to spend a lot of time in the demand management space. We're probably going to spend more time in the project strategy space because, you know, we kind of know what that technical solution looks like. It's about wireless routers and those sorts of plans. So, you know, this is not a completely linear model, and I think you tailor the use of the model and the decisions you make to the particular project, you know, and then new construction, right? You know, so there we're replacing an existing asset. You know, it may provide additional capability, right? The firing range is a really good example. I just got to replace that. okay, I may build a better firing range when I do that, which provides additional capability, or I may bring an asset online to provide an entirely new capability, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, the issue is the appropriate stage of entry into this model is project dependent.
Interestingly, okay. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just gonna say the difference between a major renovation of the entire asset and just the, you know, we've been using some system level examples,
right.
But the George Mason, I'm forgetting now, George Mason tear down, rebuild.
Yes.
Yeah, who's not?
Cora Kelly.
So it's Cora Kelly getting
you might have
new
hybrid
classrooms.
You might have a
hybrid. It's a hybrid, right?
Yeah,
so it's
a
like
hybrid.
A major renovation.
So the roof replacement's probably in kind,
mm-hmm.
you know, unless somebody makes a business case that a green roof is going to give you some benefit. But there's probably some other stuff in there. Sprinklers, right?
Mm-hmm.
It has no sprinklers in there. So I would argue sprinklers adds additional service capability. You know, it's a modernization of the existing asset that gives you additional
mm-hmm.
service capability. So it's a little bit of a hybrid. Now sprinklers is kind of, that's kind of cheating as an example, because no one's going to argue we should be putting kids in a school that doesn't have fire suppression systems.
Yeah.
But you see the point. You're going to go through some of these as a hybrid, and again, I want to keep emphasizing what we're not, or what I'm not suggesting here, because our subcommittee has not seen these before, is that this is an inflexible, unbendable model,
mm-hmm.
but it essentially suggests stages that projects probably need to address given their nature and their extent.
And we actually have the CIP divided into three categories that aren't described exactly like this, but they're basically the same. The first two are existing assets. Number one is sort of ongoing maintenance. Two is renovations and rehabilitations. And three is service expansion, new facilities.
Yeah.
And the first two are more than two-thirds of our, at least from a funding
sure.
standpoint
yeah.
on the city side, the first two are more than two-thirds of our CIP, and then the last one is less than one-third. So
right.
a lot of our CIP is in those two categories of the existing assets.
Right.
So if we were to, it's always helpful to me to try to apply this to the case at hand, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if we take the various school projects as something concrete, it's not a capability.
It may be.
Have to provide.
Well, no, but the question on the table, right, and this goes back to some of our earlier
yeah.
meetings, and this, especially with Weston, okay, and high school. So you're making some bets on student population growth and also where. So you would go back and you'd look at that and say, do I really need a new school in Weston?
But is that capability need or is that demand management?
No, that's capability
so
need.
You're saying, okay, do we believe the population and student enrollment statistics?
Right.
Okay, so you would start for some of the school projects in that place.
I would.
Okay.
I mean, not everybody would, but yeah, I would go back and say, and that goes to one of the questions that I asked earlier. Remember, I said, so how good is your predictive ability with the school, you know, model, right? And then you said very good, and I think I asked you, Mike, well, how good is very good? And I think you still owe me that answer.
Sorry, I thought we provided follow-up
in the
past 4 years, I think, of projection
yeah.
perception.
Yeah, it's on there.
You
we're
might
with,
have.
Yeah. Our goal is to be within 2%. We have been for the
right.
past 4 years.
But the question becomes, have you been in the right parts of town? Because I could wind up, you know, there was a discussion at one point on building, you know, holding the soccer fields that are across from Simpson out for a new school,
mm-hmm.
and nobody believed that we were going to wind up putting families in Potomac Yard. Now that may have changed, right? So it's one of these things, and it goes to Jeremy's point about capital projects, right? I'm so far out that for some of these I'm making big bets, right?
Yeah.
I'm making big bets that the models are accurate. So I either better be right or I better be flexible. So some of those projects, this is just kind of a personal view,
mm-hmm.
hard-headed numbers guy, yeah, I would drive some of them back
the capability needs validation. Now you look at something like George Mason, clearly not. I mean, we've got an existing school there. You know, I think that's probably more demand management, because the question is, hey, do you build on the empty field up there? Do you tear down the existing school, put up another one, and move the kids into swing space? There are different considerations.
So on that one, on that question, is it under demand management that you would ask yourself, to what standard am I going to build that school or rebuild that school?
Exactly.
And, you know, such things as classroom space per pupil or, you know.
And you could ask yourself, you know, and to that point, you start asking yourself, am I going to build a 25-year school? Am I going to build a 50-year school? Because I would argue the answers are very different. But I, you know, so everything you've heard to this point, let me make this clear, is worth what you've paid for. Right? So the whole point in putting this up here was not to say this makes sense, but was to drive a discussion. So I'm holding this as lightly as I hope everybody else is, because the point really is to kind of think through how you would model stepping through, if you will, the development life cycle of a capability. Some things that I would throw out is proposed constraints and necessary conditions. So, you know, if you had a model of governance, you know, how do you think about that? Number one, the amount of advanced planning has got to be proportionate to the project's proposed scope. And we've talked a lot about that, so I won't go back. Secondly, the data generated by analysis should be useful to stakeholders, project managers, the city manager, and council alike. I have seen too many scenarios where we have created data to check a set of artificial blocks that nobody actually uses to make decisions or to manage projects. So whatever data analysis, whatever process, you know, might evolve to inform these decisions, really ought to inform these decisions and do no more and no less than inform these decisions, because city and school staff are busy enough without doing paperwork for paperwork's sake.
Suggest an amendment to that second bullet point?
Absolutely.
I think we need to add the superintendent and the school board into that bullet.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. Fair enough, miss that. Third one is the process has got to be aligned with the annual development of the CIP. And I think it's important to think about budget life cycle in any political jurisdiction. So you are managing, city staff is managing three budgets at the same time, right? They're building one, they're helping council work through one, you know, in my business we would say defending one, and they're executing. So is schools. So you've got to align, and that's one of the reasons I sent out the pages that had the calendar on it, because I wanted people to understand, you know, how we start budgetary discussions in the city. But budgets in this environment are complex enough that whatever we did would have to be aligned with that particular process to provide any value to either city council or schools. And then the last one, the process, you know, has to be common to the city and schools. So those were four, just, you know, as I was kind of looking back at my model and say, hey, how does this work in the real world? Those were four of the things that I said, hey, you've got to keep in mind as you make, you know, this model work. Let's see, is that the last? Okay, so now we have to go back.
That's weird. It's there is a slide at the end.
Yeah.
There it is. Okay. So this takes us back. So I put this out here. We've talked some clarification. So let me just stop at this point and ask: Is there any need to answer clarifying questions? Okay, then if not, I'll open the floor for discussion.
Maybe I could ask the city staff and the school staff. And you all have a process that you use today, and I think we've heard that there's some overlap and terminology may be different. Your thoughts, I mean, because you as a practical matter, you go through a process today.
Right.
And now you've seen the suggestion. Your thoughts, I mean, I'm putting you on the spot.
No, that's
it's
fine. Good. That's fine. I think there are parts of this that look familiar, that things, some of these things that we do or we may be doing more internally that aren't as, you know, like particularly when you're looking at the first two steps of the capability analysis and the demand management. So some of that is happening. Some of these things we're doing, some of them we could probably do a little and would like to do a little bit more of, like particularly operating cost analysis and integrating that into the operating budget. So that's sort of where I am, and if you have anything to add to that.
I think there are some extremely helpful points of emphasis to this, mm-hmm. both in the feasibility phase, the alternatives that identified sort of separate commitment of reserving feasibility study to vet out the more deeper analysis. I think it's helpful to all parties involved. I think it helps with the expectation management issue down the road. And hopefully language in the sort of final recommendation has that connection. Even though you're doing feasibility, it does not create the expectation mm-hmm. that something will proceed.
Yep.
Sometimes when something hits a public budget or you know, a neighborhood sees it, they're like, huzzah, but it might not be the case. And so, I mean, that's, I think, very helpful, but also okay. there's risks involved with it that hopefully language will help to manage and set the expectations for your product to deliver to those who have set a task for you here. And then, you know, I think that the finer point on the alternatives, I think there are appropriate ways to challenge the thinking, which is helpful. Healthy. I get to deliver projects from an agnostic standpoint because I don't typically, except for fleet services, have frontline services to provide. And so I think that's always healthy to sort of take the step back, reassess a whole level of priorities, and then bring it forward through different stage gates. So I think that all those are very healthy.
I think that this is very similar to how we start talking our processes over time, but definitely aren't this clearly defined. We don't have this full process in place. I think putting a little more structure in like this and really talking about where we are in this cycle would be very helpful to us and to a lot of other stakeholders. And to Mr. Pike's point, I think that there is definitely a reluctance to start putting numbers out there and then feeling that the projects will be held to those numbers. I think that we need to start thinking about this more as iterative looks at the project as it changes, and really dedicate more to feasibility and to high-level estimates at the beginning than we're currently doing.
I would also agree with the need for that more feasibility stage, as well as the operating budget impacts. I know that's something we go back and forth with all the time, and finance asks us, you know, what would it be or what could it be, and we have a hard time really developing that. I would also say, to your point about the budget calendar, I think that's a critical piece in making sure that planning process is aligned with that calendar. A lot of times what happens is, you know, staff are working all fall and the school board and everybody and going through ad deletes and things like that to put together a proposed budget. It comes, and then in February or March, city manager releases his proposed. And then it's kind of a scramble process to figure out, okay, how are we going to align with appropriation next year? Mm-hmm. And then just kind of the other projects aren't thought out as well in the out year. So I think making sure there's a process to vet what ends up happening in final adoption would be really helpful. And to be able to work with the city to, you know, land acquisition is going to be a big problem for us as well as them. Being able to have those conversations together, I think, would be.
Yeah, I covered it. It's open discussion, so.
Council and school meet frequently, but I thought staffs were more collaborative in especially when there were large projects. And don't you regularly meet with your counterparts in the city or vice versa? Or is that not the case? Am I under a mis? Because I know city schools meet infrequently.
Right.
School board members and council. And they're always saying, well, let's let staff get together at these meetings.
Mm-hmm.
Is that just something that's a throw out for the public, or do you actually try to really coordinate?
I think we coordinate in a variety of different ways. I'm not involved with project implementation, so I don't know to what level project managers are working with planning staff, but I know that happens. I know your folks work with planning on enrollment projections, and we meet, you know, throughout the budget and CIP development process to compare notes on cost drivers and things like that.
Would it be helpful? I mean, I don't know. This is a question. Would it be helpful if there was more collaboration on especially school-related things that affect the city? It's going to affect it financially, mm-hmm. but also can affect it in many other ways.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something?
Well, I think the city manager and the superintendent are meeting on a regular basis, and we've been meeting on a regular basis. So we actually are trying to make an effort to have, I guess, more just ongoing regular interaction beyond the interaction that we already have on specific topics.
Worked on the LRFP collaboratively together.
Yep. Yep.
And you have the different work groups that you had the meeting last Wednesday there together.
And then, for instance, the joint city council, city school board met this afternoon in this room for about an hour and a half talking about a number of different joint operational and capital issues.
Right.
So at least there's dialogue that occurs. It's
so,
been a great for the last 2 or 3 years that subcommittee has really been consistent.
So I'll make an observation. So those things are very helpful and very useful. But you are putting together a 10-year CIP that has a lot of money in it, that has a fair amount of complexity in it, that has some political ramifications for obvious reasons, as well as others. And I would hope, as a taxpayer, and this is what I'm not saying, is a system that has sufficient structure to kind of drive some of the implicit assumptions that both the city and schools make about this to being explicit. And they need to be explicit, because when you have implicit assumptions, you're setting yourself up for project failure. So that's the observation that I'll make. I think there are probably the roots of a process down there, having spent 3 years on DFAC, or 6 years on DFAC and 3 years on the school's budget advisory committee. But I don't see the level of structure that the city probably needs for a CIP of this scope.
To that point, or I guess to add to the timing question earlier, as well as sort of a functional structure, because of this process, we're also functionally shifting some of our CIP planning to a 2-year framework,
mm-hmm.
Which I think is helpful from a queuing up what is the next year's
sure.
queue
yeah.
for feasibility to then prepare for. Because the timing cycle of we're building it, flying it, and
yeah,
projecting
exactly.
what the next model is going to be
right.
at the same time sort of issue. And so by giving that breadth of this year's
right.
cycle, either it's already been through feasibility and it's ready to go, and the project team is implementing A&E and through, or the only other thing that's coming through for the 2-year cycle is the feasibility in the next year. And so just the maturing of a cycle, I think, is helpful. To sort of what I hear, I know what my
yeah,
staff
yeah.
and my I experience as
yeah.
well.
Mm-hmm.
Of and it is the balance of the typical governance issue of responsiveness versus accountability.
Yeah.
And one pushing the other to get something accomplished versus the accountable side of marching something through.
And see, I think that's a false dichotomy. And generally what happens is when we set that dichotomy up, we're unhappy. So why can't we be responsive and accountable, right? So in order to do that, you need a system in which everybody understands their roles and responsibilities, understands the handoffs, and has enough flexibility to deviate from those when reasonable people who are willing to be held accountable, you know, say it's time to deviate. So I'll observe that I think that's just a false dichotomy that almost every government suffers from, by the way. So yeah. You're not alone.
Well, I think the biggest thing you said was also the expectation. And so I think that the expectation of anybody who's submitting within the CIP context understands what the level of alternatives analysis within, and it might not be that year one is not funded because of preceding step hasn't been done thoroughly.
Right.
And I think that's sort of the maturity of the cycle, setting the expectations of what that looks like.
So who makes
a sort of stage gate?
Who does make those decisions then, you know, for moving from one stage to the next?
That's an excellent question. And I think to some degree that's a policy question within the city. I think that's, you know, within the purview of city council to determine.
You're not going to recommend.
We certainly could recommend it, but I would argue that it really depends on scope and complexity, right? So, roof replacement. I mean, we're not going to not do the roof at some point. I mean, that's just so we probably don't want to go back to council. Maybe that one sits in OMB. You know, so I'll just and I am now just throwing out things I'm holding very lightly. Okay. So maybe you say, hey, if it's you know, life extension, right? The department is responsible for doing the due diligence and the decision gets made in OMB. Maybe if it's modernization of existing capability, you say department's responsible for doing the due diligence on that. OMB, you know, supports, and that's a decision that the city manager has to make. Mm-hmm. When you go to essentially new stuff, maybe you say, hey, I want to go back to council because those issues of stakeholder analysis and the amount of money that can be committed in new, new facilities requires an explicit statement on the part of the elected leadership of what those priorities are.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a way you might think about it. You might take it, you know, on a continuum of scope and complexity, and you may want to make that, and you would say, I will make that decision at the lowest level in which I believe I can assure accountability.
And maybe in the world of complexity, looking at, I mean, the schools as an example, because you have some set ed specs. So you have a set standard that's been school board approved to guide your design. And so within that world of modernization, you at least already have one benchmark set for what you're going to design to.
True. However, we are in a city that is 15 and a half square miles and short of trying to annex part of Fairfax County
mm-hmm.
and get more land, we are also constrained by the state and what the state will accept.
Mm-hmm.
So I would argue in some of those, you might wish to promote that level of decision-making to a higher level and say, because of the political engagement you're going to need with the State Board of Education, I really need to do this. So I think you've got to look at an entire set of complexity, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's not just, okay, I've got this capability and I've got this set of either specifications or best practices that drives this profession,
mm-hmm.
but there's this entirely other dimension around it that we don't control as a Dillon rule state
mm-hmm.
that has to be taken into consideration. How you do that, I mean, I guess we could think about that and make a recommendation.
Yeah, we're not going to get the document. A couple observations. I mean, one, this issue of the respective staffs that Marsh would be bringing us. It seems to me that a recommendation we should make is that that be formalized, and so it's not really subject to, you know, what this city manager and this superintendent think. It's actually, there is a joint capital planning. We would even use the nomenclature that we are using for our own study. There's a joint capital planning and implementation work group, which is comprised of city staff and their counterparts from the ACPS staff. And their job is actually to manage this process on a consolidated basis. Each of you will have to go off and do your own work.
Right.
But you're going to come together, and everybody's going to know at a very early stage the work that's taking place. So for the alternatives and for those things, that's all surfacing. I mean, that would seem a reasonable approach.
And that would probably provide the artifacts to allow City Council to make an informed judgment about how the CIP is phased. Mm-hmm.
And to that end, I think that, to me, one of the most significant things coming out of our discussion tonight is this issue of seed money. Because again, I reflect on, why are we here? We're here because there's great dissatisfaction with how the city is spending its capital dollars. You can't pick up a newspaper every week, and it's usually the same guy writing the letters. That's enough of an editorial comment. But you read about how we've screwed it up. The school board has screwed it up, or the city has screwed it up, and we've gone significantly over budget. And I think, in fairness to everybody involved, that if those projects had seed money, and you'd had the opportunity to actually do the feasibility study in the correct way and understand the capabilities that you were going to build, those projects probably would not have been significant. We all would have had a much better idea when they were built what they were going to cost. So it seems to me part of our job is to figure out how that stuff doesn't happen anymore. And I think, Elliot, your comment about seed money goes a long way to that. Now, there's risks to it. Because right now, you put a project down and somebody comes up with an estimate, and the council goes and approves, and it turns out the estimate's off by a factor of two. You could come back out of the feasibility phase, and if the project pencils out at twice what you guys thought it was going to be, there may not be a second phase for that project. But to me, that's a reasonable outcome.
And that's victory.
Yeah.
Okay. Because what happens otherwise is we start to then scope on an ad hoc basis projects to make them affordable. And when we make them affordable, we rarely deliver the capability that the citizens want. So you just hear about it for the next 20 years. Exhibit A is a pool at Chinkopin.
Is what?
Okay, the pool at Chinkopin. All right, we decided we weren't going to pay for that. It was an affordability issue.
Way back when.
It's short of an Olympic pool. And we hear all the time how we can't hold swim meets, how we can't generate revenue, how we can't really adequately service the population of D.C. So we scoped it to the dollars we were willing to spend on it. And by God, we took off the end of that. And, you know, and if you talk to people, you know, who care about Chinkopin, they will tell you, you people screwed up because you didn't build an Olympic-sized pool. So would you rather kill it and have folks mad at you for the next 12 months for killing it? Or would you rather have them mad at you for the next 20 years for inadequately scoping and building something that was supposed to deliver capability?
To your previous comment, but I think it's related, questioning even existing asset renewal, I'd still have each of them go through that. At least for assets require more than 25% of capital renewal to that asset.
Okay.
Yeah. That's sort of a threshold. It's not just a chiller replacement or boiler, but you've got a multi-system replacement. It's probably healthy to go through that same. We're doing it for 44 Eddie King Street right now for other assets where we have significant recapitalization to do. We're doing a lot of reevaluation as part of it. We'll report on that in October, November.
Yeah.
But sure, you want to look at that whole portfolio and say, hey, is this asset beyond economic repair? Do I want to just scrap it and start over again?
Reposition.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So.
So where do we go from here? For future.
Well, I was just looking at my watch, and we're just about at the end of our time, and I certainly want to be respectful. First of all, I appreciate everybody's feedback. And here's what I think I'm hearing. I think I'm hearing we're doing a lot of this, both in the city and schools, that we have a tendency to do it on more of an ad hoc basis. So the processes are not evenly or uniformly applied by project, that there is probably some benefit to putting some structure in this because it will help us to make some decisions up front, which may save us both money and time in execution or increase customer satisfaction. So I think I'm hearing the model is reasonably relevant and appropriate, that it does need some modifications. I think we've talked a bit about some of the questions that should be answered, in general, not by stage. We had a brief discussion about who might be empowered to proceed, and cast that in terms of scope and complexity of the projects. And we talked a little bit, I think, about funds flow, most notably the idea of providing seed money to do the real upfront feasibility work to determine whether a project really made the grade. Marshall, Eric, is that a fair summary of the discussion we've had from your perspective?
Yeah, and I think it would be, at this stage, it would seem to me that between the consultants and the staff, if they took what we crafted as the starting point and incorporate the discussion and add, I think we've added a few things, add that.
Mm-hmm.
And I would encourage, as you do that, that you're consulting with, with Morgan and with Jeremy and Erica and Mike to say, okay, given the context of how it works today, is this workable? I mean, you guys saw it for the first time tonight. And how can we make this a consistent process across both the city and the schools?
So I think, to proceed, that's probably the discussion we want to have at our next meeting. So I think we want to come back to these four questions and be prepared to have a more structured discussion around them. So let's plan to take them in order. So as people, think about the model as we presented it,
mm-hmm.
the clarifications we've offered, let's come back with some things we would want to do to modify it. Let's start to kind of brainstorm a list of the information, the questions you'd like to have answered, or the information that should be available at the end of each one of those stages. If you guys want to recast it in your nomenclature,
mm-hmm.
I'm certainly fine with that. I am not wed to
right.
to a word. But I think what I would like to recommend is that whatever nomenclature gets used gets adopted by both schools and the city. So there is a common set of terms of reference through which communication occurs. It would be helpful to get some thoughts around the empowerment question and also I think to discuss funds flow. So given the constraint of both full funding projects as well as the requirement under the Virginia Code that schools be given a certain amount of autonomy with respect to executing their budget, how we would make sure that value for dollar gets lined up in the process.
Could we also ask that second bullet point, the issue of what questions should be answered? Could we ask staff and consultants to actually go back. We've had discussions at the plenary session mm-hmm. about questions, criteria, things like that.
We've got a list. Yeah.
Okay.
To bring that back in within this
okay.
framework.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So if we could line that up, that would be good. Mm-hmm. All right. So with that, Eric, you good?
I'm good. Thank you.
Marshall.
I'm running drag on this committee, and sometimes I have to do a lot of homework to keep up with you and Eric's start, but I'm good.
Okay. We appreciate your bringing the eminent common sense to the table. So just around the table from staff. Any other comments?
Thank you.
Nope, thank you.
Maureen?
Okay. Well, could I just thank you? Because, I mean, there's a lot of work that you personally put into this to get this discussion rolling. So thank you.
Pleasure. Thank you. Okay. Then I guess we're just about on time.